G'day mate, how you going? This is Adam O'Brien and welcome to Fandom Podcast Network, here where we enjoy all forms of fandom. Well, coming to you live from Quinlan's Cantina in the Gold Coast of Australia, I bring you Lethal Mullet Podcast, an Australian look at B-grade action films from the 1980s. That's right, going back to that beloved time when we had Chuck Norris on almost every Friday night here in Australia, kicking, punching, and shooting his way to the top, alongside Jean-Claude Van Damme, Arnold Schwarzenegger, and the likes of many of the others that came after him, Sylvester Stallone. We even look at some of the heroes you may not know, all here on one Fortnite with Podcasts here on the Fandom Podcast Network. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can check it out also on Podbean if you've got the Podbean app. Make sure you check it out. Now, let's get into the episode here on Fandom Podcast Network.
G'day mate, how you going? This is Adam O'Brien, the Lethal Mullet here on Fandom Podcast Network's The Lethal Mullet Podcast. Joining me here tonight to talk about Space Hunter, Adventures in the Forbidden Zone, is the co-founder, of course, of this here channel, Kevin the Raider Nerd Reitzel. And he's going to be chatting about his love of this and much, much more. We have a little bit of insight into a few action movies here and there and much, much more. Stay tuned, folks. Here we go.
All right, before we get into the episode tonight, here's where you can catch this show and many others like it on Fandom Podcast Network at fpnet.podbean.com, which is our main master feed. You also catch the actual show itself on the Podbean app. It's one of the greatest ways to check out the show. Also, if you like all the shows, you can catch them at all these different places where you can catch podcasts on iTunes, Stitcher, Podbean, and, of course, Google Play if you're an Android user. Now, also, on social media channels, you can find us on Twitter at FanPodNetwork. And on Facebook, you can catch us at Fandom Podcast Network's page there at facebook.com/FandomPodcastNetwork. If you want to catch us on the email lines, email any ideas you have that the show might be able to cover, any other films you think that have been fantastic, you can catch us at FandomPodcastNetwork@gmail.com. You can catch me, the host, Adam O'Brien, at obpopculture on Twitter and, of course, on Instagram as well. Same handle. And don't forget to catch me on my other show, The Fantha from Down Under, a fortnightly look at Star Wars from Down Under on Fantha Tracks Radio or FanthaTracks.com. And also check out the great shows that I'm doing here on Fandom Podcast Network's Couch Potato Theatre, where we look at Mad Max with Maximum Couch Potato, and also our brand new show, The Spicing Guild, looking at the adaptations of Frank Herbert's Dune. Now, let's get into the show.
G'day mate, how you going? This is Adam O'Brien, the Lethal Mullet himself, on Lethal Mullet Podcast, here, brought to you by the one, the only, Fandom Podcast Network. Joining me today as guest co-host here is the co-founder of this amazing saga of podcasts and, of course, the channel itself. Also, the host of Blood of Kings and many other amazing shows, even the Hair Metal Podcast. The one, the only, the Reitzelmeister, the one, the only, Kevin the Raider Nerd Reitzel. Pal, how are you?
What's up, man? Good to be back on Lethal Mall. I love the show, man. Thanks for having me on.
You're welcome. Now, today we're going to be looking at some great science fiction that you guys probably may not have seen, because especially out here in Australia, very limited release, but VHS went balls. I mean, it went everywhere. That is, of course, the one, the only, Space Hunter, Adventures in the Forbidden Zone. Mate, are you excited to talk about this one today?
I am. I'm really excited. This was a film I kind of rediscovered. I have a vague memory of maybe seeing it in the drive-in, but I'm not entirely sure. But I do remember seeing it on TV originally, or when it came out on TV. But I remember they were trying to – I think they were going to release it later in the year, but that same year it was Return of the Jedi that was coming out. And they actually released it like a week or two before to try and jump on the excitement that people – like the kind of science fiction bandwagon, so to speak.
Yeah, it's different, wasn't it? The fact that you got these films that try to tie in at a time of massive releases, especially the third in the classic trilogy of the time. And I think, too, it was quite, for us out here, VHS just went absolutely ballistic with it. You could never find it. If you went in, it always said, I'm rented already, little sticker on the side of it here in Australia. Funnily enough, now this is a little bit trip down memory lane, Blockbuster Video had a Blockbuster that was not the main franchise started out when I first got that VHS copy. I went, hang on, that's not the Blockbuster with the blue and yellow star-spangled sort of banner that they had for the poster. So a completely different one. But one of the things I remember from it was the big rigs, the big trucks and the big, I suppose, hardware that was used in the film. And, of course, somebody I didn't realise was Michael Ironside, which we're going to get into later, that looked like the Terminator. And it was quite well done.
Yeah, definitely the practical effects stood out in this with the vehicles and the equipment and the guns and stuff like that. The vehicles in this are really, really cool. I think they even rivaled Mad Max and were maybe even inspired to a certain degree, especially Mad Max 2. But I remember, too, this movie was trying to make kind of its own statement by doing 3D. There was kind of a run of 3D films, you know, back in the early 80s, where you'd wear those white, red, the white framed with the red and the blue 3D glasses. And this one was shot in 3D. And I don't think I saw it originally in 3D, but I know it was released in 3D in certain theaters.
Oh, without a doubt. Now, folks, today we're going to be talking about that. Also, before we get into Space Hunter, we're also going to be talking about some action movies that we're going to be catching up with you guys with. So we're going to be talking about those. And, of course, a deep dive into Peter Strauss's amazing role as Wolf. That's right. Peter who, you say? Peter who? Peter Strauss. That's right. Peter Gunn. If people remember that one as well from the 80s.
Just when you thought it was safe to go back into space, Christopher Nolan brings you a brand new vision of the future of space travel. All the way into the far future, we have Interstellar 2, starring Michael Caine as Michael Caine.
Hello, this is Michael Caine, and I am in a spaceship. Here in space with a cognac, and I'm checking out the stars and all the pitch black there is. That's right, very exciting movie by Christopher Nolan.
Kevin, where can the folks find you?
You can find me on Twitter and Instagram at Spartan_Phoenix.
Awesome. Now, if you also want to catch the other co-founder of this amazing channel, Kyle Wagner, you can catch him at AColeW on Twitter and on Instagram, AColeFandom. But don't forget, you can also support the Fandom Podcast in two ways. On TeePublic, where you can find all the shows with amazing apparel when it comes to T-shirts. So visit the TeePublic store where you can help support the show there with all the different logos and stuff you can get on there too. And iTunes, please leave us a review on iTunes. Be generous. Give us 5 stars, of course. And we love feedback in all forms. Now, let's get into some action movie catch-up here. And Kevin is going to take it away with something that he wants to let you guys know about.
Yeah. Okay, so on the big screen, you know, we've got Shazam coming out. Looking forward to that. But on the video front, so to speak, I guess, and this is something that you brought to my attention, was the movie Bone Tomahawk.
Yes.
A Western starring Kurt Russell, kind of a gritty Western. And I remember getting it, and I was like, whoa, this is intense. And I remember the violence in it being pretty intense as well. But it was a really good Western. I think he had just done Hateful Eight, Tarantino's film. So he had that big beard and everything. And so he definitely looked the role in that. But a friend of mine at work turned me on to another movie by that director, and the director is S. Craig Zoller, the director of Bone Tomahawk, and he's done 2 other films. And the movie that my coworker told me about was Brawl in Cell Block 99, starring Vince Vaughn. And I'd heard about the film, and I was just like, I don't know. But my friend was like, you got to watch this movie. You got to watch this movie. And he's basically a former boxer turned drug runner. He loses his job, and he and Vince Vaughn, I got to tell you straight off the bat, his best role to date, if you ask me. He was really good in this. And he ends up going to prison, and in order to save his pregnant wife from being killed, basically, he has to find someone in prison and kill them. But the problem is he's not in the right prison. So how do you go from one prison to a bad prison? That's even worse. You do bad stuff. the character developments in it stars also Jennifer Carpenter and Don Johnson. And I got to tell you, the fight scenes in this movie, they're mostly like fist and like, you know, blunt objects and stuff. It is brutal. It is really graphic and brutal. And the character development was really good. And Vince Vaughn was just really good in this. And so I highly recommend Brawl in Cell Block 99. And also there's a new movie that just came out on, I think it's coming out on video soon. It was released late last year, starring also Vince Vaughn, I guess they're buddies, and Mel Gibson, called Dragged Across Concrete. They play two cops that are not the best cops in the world, and they get suspended. And they decide to try to rip off a heist of some criminals to get some money and take care of them and their families. And then there's a side story of brothers, one of them played by Michael Jai White, who are involved in this heist and how they're trying to figure out how they're going to get out of this alive with the people that are pulling the strings. It also was brutal when it came to violence as well. I'm becoming a huge fan of this director, S. Craig Zahler. I would say he's the perfect combination of the Coen brothers and Tarantino. So check it out.
So he really seems to, in the movies that I've seen, really work, in particular, the idea of character development to an absolute maximum. Bone Tomahawk in particular.
Yeah.
You know, before any of the, you know, we're starting to see the conflicts between characters. We're starting to see ones that, you know, what's going on here? What are they trying to take advantage of? And then, boom, an outside element comes in that film, which you just don't know what's going to happen. And I think that's how he works it.
Yeah, he does definitely spend a lot of time with character development. The Dragged Across Concrete is his longest film. It's a little over 2.5 hours. And there's a lot of character development in that, because there's so many pieces to this plot and this heist that happens. Mm-hmm. And he's trying to paint the picture of everyone, not just, you know, these cops may seem like they're the good guys, but they're not. And the bad guys may seem like the bad guys, but maybe not, depending on what side of the fence you're on there. So that's why it feels very Tarantino, you know. And then the writing as well. So I highly recommend. I'm a fan of Craig Zahler. I'm all in.
Awesome. Yeah, I'd like to, Vince has sort of moved his way through, and you know, one of the great things about what he's done recently, obviously he's worked in a lot of mainstream stuff in comedy, and you know, over the years, we're starting to see a development where he's gone a little bit more serious. But to me, the actual role that he's done the best, and you see a real development, is Hacksaw Ridge.
I remember that, actually. And he also worked with Mel Gibson then, if I remember correctly, right?
That's right. So yeah. I mean, we're talking about a film and shot here in Australia.
It's funny you say that, because while he was on that set, he had as in Vince Vaughn, told Mel Gibson about the Dragged Across Concrete script that he got. And so that's how he got him involved in that. And yes, he was good in that. But I'll tell you right now, I'm the Brawl and the title is a little misleading. When you think of a brawl, you think of like all the inmates fighting. It's not like that. There's only a few that are involved, and there's a reason why, because it gets really brutal. You'll notice a few actors from these films. He tends to ask back actors that were in, like In Dragged Across Concrete and Brawl and Cell Block 99, you got Don Johnson in there. You got also Jennifer Carpenter in those films as well, playing different characters. Don Johnson was great in Brawl and Cell Block 99. Oh, man. But I highly recommend to check it out. They're really good.
I loved it. And I've got to talk about a film also, folks, which I think all of you need to check out. Now, you probably already have. Warner Brothers have been pumping out, with DC, let's just say, less than favorable films over the last couple of years, with obviously Man of Steel sort of kicking off this new direction of films. There's been hit or miss here and there, which one's good, but Wonder Woman, fantastic. And this one, wow, I am just still buzzing from the happiness that I've got after this film. I don't know what it is, because the film itself, story-wise, is pretty run-of-the-mill. That is, of course, James Wan's Aquaman. I got to say, I loved it. Everything about this film feels like a prequel Star Wars film, as far as how much, you know, different worlds, different places we're taken to. And the mythology that's given to us is richer than anything I've seen on screen that Marvel's put out. I'm going to have to say, this guy's right up there.
DC?
Yeah, DC, yeah.
Yeah, DC. Yeah, you said Marvel, so I was confused.
I certainly did. No, I meant Marvel there. I think it's actually a richer mythology in one film than I've seen anything that Marvel's put out, because they're doing a mythology that spans all the different sagas. So, like, say, Thor's probably the only one that would compete as far as a rich mythology in its own little sort of film. I'm talking about one film per, like, area. So if you look at Aquaman, if it's one mythology within one film, there's just so much depth that's created there. And I think along with the cast and also the design of this film, I'm really pretty surprised.
Yeah, I overall enjoyed it. I thought it was really good. I thought Nicole Kidman was great in it. I thought it was – I didn't think it was too jokey. I thought it was funny in the right parts. Jason Momoa is great. He's just got good charisma. And I enjoyed the look of the underwater world. So yeah.
And of course, Tamara Morrison as his dad. I mean,
yeah,
you've got to love it. Now, you've also found a couple of films with Michael Dudikoff.
We know Michael Dudikoff from the American Ninja films, and he's kind of, you know, through the 90s there, the late 80s and early 90s, he's kind of one of the B-movie action heroes, a lot of straight-to-video stuff. He had a short-lived TV series called Cobra, which I'll touch on another time. But I was kind of looking through his catalog, and I came across these two movies that he did called Bounty Hunters. And the first one's called Bounty Hunters, and then the second one is called Bounty Hunters 2 Hardball. And he co-stars with Lisa Howard, who Highlander fans might know as Dr. Anne Lindsay from, I think, season 3 and 4. She had a limited run on there as the doctor that had a romantic interest relationship with Duncan MacLeod. And these two films were both filmed in Vancouver, which is where the first half of Highlander seasons were shot before they went over to the second half over in Paris and filmed them there. I wasn't quite sure what to expect. I thought it might have been more of a little hard edge type action films, but actually, and I wasn't disappointed by this. It was more it's kind of like Moonlighting, but bounty hunters instead of investigators. And because these characters both have had, they're both involved previously, and they're both kind of working against each other, both as bounty hunters trying to one-up each other, but then they're kind of forced to work together. So there's a little bit more humor than I expected in it. But and I got to tell you, Michael Dudikoff with humor kind of surprised me. He was better than I thought he would be. I enjoyed them both. I enjoyed the second one, Bounty Hunters 2 Hardball, a little bit more. Mm-hmm. There's a little bit more action in there and stuff. It was nice to see Michael Dudikoff, kick a little butt too, but also Anne Lindsay do some martial arts and kick some butt too. So yeah, these probably have gotten lost in the DVD graveyard of a lot of films that went straight to video or Blockbuster and stuff. And I actually had to search hard to find this. I definitely saw VHS copies out there, but I actually got a DVD that has both of them on the same one. So Bounty Hunters, Michael Dudikoff.
The Dudikoff. And you will catch him as a obviously a subject on this here podcast in future. What we do, you American think? Ninja. You think? Yeah, it might be. Now, we're also going to be covering some great films in the next month or so here on the show. We're also going to be looking at some Westerns. Now, folks, if you're a big fan of Clint Eastwood, well, I'm going to be covering a couple of Eastwood films, especially Pale Rider, which I absolutely adore. I think it's one of the, not the greatest, but it's a quintessential Western, along with one of the greats, Tango and Cash. Oh, I can't wait to get into this one.
Yeah, you're in my wheelhouse there, brother. That's one of my favorites.
That's the one.
One of my wish list for years to get a sequel of, but we never did.
That's right. Now, I've got to say, for you folks out there, just as a little tease, the film is not what it was intended to be. That film was meant to be a serious crime drama, not an action film, believe it or not.
Yeah, no, that movie went through a lot of changes, a lot of editing too.
That's right. So we're going to go through a lot of that when we get to it. But tonight, we're going to be talking about Peter Strauss playing Wolf in this amazing film. The first thing we're going to do is give you a bit of a tease on what the film's about. So check this out. The film came out in 1983 as Space Hunter Adventures in the Forbidden Zone in 3D. That's right. So this film had a tagline, it's pretty much Journey with Wolf and Nikki, an interstellar adventurer and young rebel on a mission to rescue three stranded women from a planet no one has warned them about because no one has ever returned. I mean, it's just brilliant. Captures the essence of what this film is all about. So it was a space western, obviously starring the cast, which we're about to talk about, produced by Ivan Reitman. You know, the one that Arnold says makes fantastic movies. That's right. Ivan Reitman, you have to do this. Do it now. Now. So we got all those great.
Ivan's a legend too, man. He's done a lot of stuff.
That's right. We wouldn't have John Kimball if it wasn't for Ivan Reitman. We wouldn't have Ghostbusters if it wasn't for Ivan Reitman.
Yeah.
the film obviously had adventurous music by Elmer Bernstein as well. 3D format was the big part of that. And obviously, too, the film is about bounty hunters as well, which is a very popular thing thanks to Boba Fett in space. Now, the film itself obviously is quite a short one when you think of it. It's about 90-minute runtime. But I tell you what, why don't we tell you what's in this film? It is jam-packed. But before we get into our look at the plot itself, we're going to go right into the plot very soon. But let's have a look at the cast. Starring as the lead, Wolf is Peter Strauss. So what do we think of Peter?
You know, Peter for me was always one of those character actors. I know he had some leading roles, but he was never really on my radar until probably this movie here. He's been a very busy working man. I know he was in one of the Triple X movies where I think he was the president. He's been in a lot of stuff. But I can't really think of anything else that really stood out for me than man, he's just been in so many stuff. I don't know. Like, I think he was in Slapshot. I think he was that hockey film.
Hey, Peter
Gunn. Yeah, because I'm looking at his IMDb here. Yeah, he was the president in State of the Union. I think that was the one without Vin Diesel. That was the one with Ice Cube.
That was yeah.
He's been in some TV series I've never heard of. he was in Godzilla, the TV series, whatever.
Oh my God.
Yeah. A lot of kind of, short lived stuff, I guess, to be with the end. He's done some voice work too. He was in the 1996, he was in The Real Adventures of Johnny Quest. So yeah, but give it to him. He's been a busy, busy actor. But this is the movie that I remember him from more than I think anything else. I know he was in Rich Man, Poor Man. the Jericho Mile, Masada in 81. So, but yeah, like he's just one of those good character actors you see kind of pop up every now and then.
So what do we think of him in this film as Wolf?
Surprisingly good. I kind of wish I would have seen more of him in this style of roles, I guess. He's charismatic. He's good looking. He kind of plays a Han Solo, rugged anti-hero type thing. And so I thought he was enjoyable.
He's really good. He was great. And of course we have as Nikki, Molly Ringwald.
Molly, we all know Molly. Molly very, very well. Yeah. 16 Candles and Breakfast Club and Pretty in Pink.
The Stand.
Yeah.
The Stand.
Yeah, and she's gone on to do a lot of other TV series. And I remember Not Another Teen Movie was a parody movie off of all the other teen comedies. She did that. And she was like the cutest thing ever, you know? She kind of plays this little spunky tracker girl that, tags along with the adventure here after, Wolf loses his companion. One of the funny scenes I like is when he forces her to take a bath because she's like really dirty.
And now the next actor playing Washington was in The Crow and has an immortal line. At least they don't do that walking against the wind shit. I hate that.
That's from The Crow. Ernie Hudson.
The man. How are we thinking about his role here? It's a little bit different. I actually was surprised how good he was in this as well. Like, just, I mean, he's great in everything he does, but he really offsets Wolf quite well.
Did you say his name? I don't think you said his name.
Yeah, Ernie Hudson.
Oh, okay, good. I didn't hear you say his name. Yeah, otherwise known as the fourth Ghostbuster, of course.
Oh, yeah.
Ernie Hudson, man, played Washington. I love that rig that he drove with, like, the big snowplow thing in the front of it.
It's beautiful. Yeah.
Yeah. I know that I think he did this right before Four Ghostbusters, I think, if I remember correctly. He was fun in this role. My only complaint is he wasn't in the movie enough.
Yes. Yeah. I agree. I think he needed to be, this is how I would have seen it. And we'll go through this with the plot very soon, but I would have liked to have seen Washington maybe be a bit more of an adversary at first, a little bit like Lando Calrissian is to Han Solo or any other plot-driven film where you got two hunters or two competitors, and then something forms them together a lot faster. Obviously, we find out that there's not just a rivalry there, but a friendship.
Yeah, yeah.
It's great. Agreed. Then we have, of course, as Chalmers, Andrea Markovici.
When I rewatched this recently, I forgot what happened to her character. She actually is a sophisticated, like, android, basically. Mm-hmm. But when you first see her kind of sitting in the captain's chair and her legs put up, you're like, whoa, she's a hottie, you know?
Oh, yeah.
unfortunately, her character dies in the first 20 minutes or so when they're trying to rescue their first attempt to rescue these three women that crashed. Mm-hmm. I really liked her character. She was a spunky, cool little sidekick, and she was good looking too.
Definitely. And of course, brings us to Overdog, played by Michael Ironside.
You know, his character, when you look at his makeup, because he's in this contraption that kind of moves him around for some reason, I guess there's, you know, and he has these prosthetics, but he kind of looks like Skeletor a little bit with his face makeup. He's got these big arm claw things. He's good. My only problem with the character is that he's not very mobile. He's kind of stuck where he is. So he relies on his minions. Kind of reminds me of Jabba the Hutt, actually.
Where the arms are like a Dalek from, Doctor Who going, exterminate, exterminate. You know, that's kind of the way, I suppose, he's limited range of motion with the arms.
Yeah, but he's very demonic looking, and Michael Ironside's just great at playing the heavy. You know, my favorite role that he's ever done, though, of course, is Total Recall, and then he was also good in Starship Troopers. But it's just a weird though, just to see a villain that can't really move around too much, and so he relies on a lot of help with the his minions.
Of course, and we know Sean Connery has a favorite Michael Ironside role. It's a true story, General Katana.
No, he does not.
No, he does not. Katana, all right, folks, with the rest.
that's actually one of my least favorite roles that Ironside's done, because he's admitted to kind of phoning that role in and just kind of overplaying it too much, you know.
Oh yeah.
He was trying to. It was just like a really bad Kurgan knockoff role, and that's my one beef with that movie, if anything, and not the whole Zeist thing. It's Katana, because if you go back and watch that movie Highlander 2, he never kills an immortal. He only kills immortals, so he's not that good of an immortal.
But what I loved about it too is that if you look at the documentaries of Highlander 2, The Quickening, you can go back. And you could see before they did the film, they actually were going to do a quite decent, serious take on each of those characters. But then they saw the script and went, pretty much.
Yeah, Ironside was just in it for the paycheck.
And folks, go on to the Blood of Kings Facebook page, where you'll see the brand new casting of the new Highlander. That is, of course, Highlander 2, The Quickening, Engage.
Stop.
All right, so let's get into the plot of this film. It is set in the 22nd century. Now, when usually a lot of those films do that, we straight away think space. We don't think Mad Max, but this is the kind of environment we're heading into is more Mad Max-like. So it opens up with the destruction of a massive space cruise liner, and we get to see a little bit of space, a little bit of a nebula. We get this amazing environment, which for 3D would have been fantastic in the 1980s. And we have three survivors of that crash, Nova, Rena, and Megan, who basically land on this uninhabitable planet, so they think. And they quickly found that they've got hostiles attacking the camp straight away after them, and they're taken. And of course, in space, an alert goes out for these guys after they've been kidnapped for 3,000 mega credits. And of course, every small-time spacer, or in this case, bounty hunter, needs to go out and check him out. And of course, this is job four, Wolf, played by Peter Strauss. So he finds the message and heads directly to the planet. This is where we meet Chalmers, the engineer, who also tells him about Terra 11. So what do we think about this opening? Pretty expansive opening, wasn't it?
Yeah, you know, the special effects for the space cruiser were definitely dated, but it looked really cool. And I really liked the escape pod that the three girls were in, and you see it land. You could definitely tell it's a model that lands on a ground somewhere. I thought it was effective, and it was interesting to see them getting out of their escape pod. And because it kind of reminded me of that scene in Demolition Man where John Spartan crashes his car, but that foam stuff covers up inside, so it protects him. It was kind of a similar thing with those girls. And then they start to realize that these there's inhabitants. They're like these kind of – it kind of reminded me of the characters from Chud, Cannibalistic Humanoid Underground Dwellers. Yeah. And they're kind of making these weird noises, and they capture them. But what I like is when you switch back over to the good guy, of course, Wolf and Chalmers in his ship. And his ship kind of reminds me a little bit of how it looks used and lived in, kind of like the Millennium Falcon did. And there's also there's something that goes wrong with the computer or something. It actually makes an R2-D2 noise, and that's done on purpose. But this is where you learn about Wolf and Chalmers and kind of how they are together and how they're partners and how they're going to try and get this 3,000 mega credits reward to rescue these people. And And then, of course, they land on the planet, and they pull out that cool car. I think it's the thing that's called the Scrambler. Mm-hmm. And this is where you get introduced to a lot of really cool practical vehicles and effects.
It really is. It's like a supersized version of Mad Max. And if anything, I was kind of trying to think about what does the Scrambler look like, or even the vehicles that we see in this. And the only comparison I could think is probably Fury Road now, because of the size of those vehicles. They're just massive vehicles. So when you look at especially the Scrambler, or even your utilitarian sort of view of Wolf's ship itself, everything's practical. As you say, mm-hmm. everything was stuff that you would use. It's not about the beauty of it, but I love the fact that they look like they could actually work.
Yeah, exactly.
It's brilliant. So after landing on the world, Wolf and Chalmers, obviously in their massive Scrambler, then start to battle a group of marauders. Now, this group of marauders are called Zoners, and also a bunch of nomads there, which are called the Scabs. So they're kind of, again, it's a battle going on in media res, and they're thrown right in the middle of it. And it's quite an exciting scene, actually, when we see Wolf basically doing the heroic thing of trying to get those girls free of trouble.
The best part about this scene is the vehicle that I think it's the Scavs have, mm-hmm. because they're attacked by the Zoners, because the Scavs are the ones that have the women, and the Zoners are trying to take them away from them. But the vehicle is this really – it's on this really cool, like, train that looks cross between a train and a pirate ship, right?
Yes.
Because it's rolling on a track. And that thing is really, really cool. That thing's better than anything I've seen in Mad Max, I'll tell you right now, including the costumes and the weapons they were using. And then you see the Zoners show up in these cool, like, motorcycles. I think they're either three-wheel motorcycles or really cool.
Tripods.
Yeah, or two-wheel motorcycles that have these really cool, like, outer chassis on them. And then you got the ones that have the flying I guess hang gliders that are kind of like have a propulsion system on them. And that was just a really cool scene, because you see Wolf jumping on that train thing and fighting and trying to help rescue these girls. It was really, really cool. And then of course, then we get introduced to the character of Nikki.
Oh, definitely. So obviously Chalmers gets killed here, and Wolf thinks that he's going to have to basically go solo pretty much after this. But this is where we meet the Scav, known as Nikki, as she tries to steal the actual Scrambler. She tries to steal the car.
Yeah, she doesn't know how it works, and it's kind of like someone trying to drive stick for the first time, and they're grinding, and you're just like, oh, God, stop it,
Well, he's brilliant. I think one of the things is straight away you set off that she knows nothing. She's very eager to try and take whatever she can and scavenge. She lives up to the scab mentality, but obviously Wolf, smarter than ever, is able to pull her into basically
He's getting ready to leave her, and then she convinces him to let her tag along and that she can help because she's a tracker, but then she's also really hungry. She needs food.
So after that, obviously, we have the women themselves that have been taken away with the hang gliders, which is quite in that action scene is quite interesting scene where they're literally picked up. It's almost like hawks coming down to take prey.
Yes.
In some way.
Yep.
But they're taken before the chemist, which is basically the henchman to Michael Ironside's Overdog. This is where we start to see the claws. We start to see some of the real, mechanical machinations of this character. And he basically gives drugs to the girls, prepared for them for Overdog's pleasure.
Yes. Yeah, that guy was really creepy looking. Again, this is another thing that this movie excels on that I think, if you take the story is pretty kind of generic, but it really excels in the visuals in several different avenues. And that is obviously the practical effects, the vehicles, And this is where you see the costumes and the makeup. And then the sets themselves, as we'll get into a little bit later, when he kind of dives more into this kind of underworld place. But it's visually, this movie's stunning. It really is.
It really is. And, of course, when we see next is the snowplow coming and basically plowing to camp as we have Wolf and Nikki sitting down, having their cuppa going, get our money going, and all of a sudden this massive, huge snowplow rocks up. And he goes, hey, I was in Ghostbusters.
Yeah. Well, it's a cross between a big snowplow and like a bulldozer. And it's all rusted and worn, and it's it looks like it's run by steam because it's got this exhaust that's going, and it's a very menacing sound when it's moving, and eventually, the soldier Washington, of course, comes out, and then Wolf is able to finally disarm him, and then they kind of become friends, I guess, sort of.
But of course he's an old acquaintance of his, you know, they knew each other beforehand, but him being lost, Washington actually crash landed his ship on there. He's been stuck on there ever since. So he's basically trying to find a way off the planet itself, which is again, brings them together because they're both in the same predicament now. So with Nikki in hand, the two of them basically go through more little adventures. And this time, with these sort of, I suppose, mutants, if you like, these strange women and water dragon as well. You know, there's, again, they're faced with different adventures as okay. they head towards.
We got to talk about these Amazon type women because yes. they okay. So this is a really cool scene of the film where the scrambler is going through this kind of underground water area. Then they come across these huntress women that are like Amazonian style, and they're kind of a cross between Amazon women and maybe mermaids, except except they don't have flippers and stuff like that because they live partially underwater, and there's like this strange creature that's underneath there. Nikki gets captured, but you know, first they make a joke about capturing Wolf and that he'll be good for breeding, you know, and I gotta tell you, man, this is one of my favorite scenes because these chicks are hot. Their outfits. And then Nikki's threatened. She gets caught in this net that they captured her in. And there's a strange creature, like kind of like a serpent type creature with these horns and stuff that looks pretty cool. And it's all practical effects. This is what I love about this movie. There's no CG. There's like hardly any special effects except maybe that space scene in the beginning with the space.
Pretty much.
I don't know. But yeah, I really enjoyed that scene.
But not just that, the women themselves, as good looking as they are tough as nails. And that's, I think, what makes it such a brilliant part of the story. Again, women in this are so strong. The fact that even Nikki herself is able to scavenge by herself. How long has she been out there on the planet by herself? We don't know at this stage.
Yeah.
Of course, he even loses the scrambler. At this stage and has to go on foot after this. So the kind of thing is his character gets everything stripped away from him as he goes. And he's got is himself and his blaster as he goes on from this too. So obviously Wolf and Washington decided to join forces to sneak into the Overdog's basically his home, his fortress, whatever you want to call it. But they also know that the Zoners have been kept prisoner inside it too. So I think that's part of the driving part of this last 30 minutes of the film.
And again, this whole set here is just phenomenal. I just love the sets in this. And this is one of the things that they have great exterior shots, which we'll talk more about where they're filmed and such, but that whole underground area is just fantastic.
Yeah. It's obviously, I think a part of this film is less a sci-fi, more a medieval sort of, I suppose, dungeon fest in some ways.
It's a good combination of both, basically. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And even, and then there's the road movie to this, because it is the part of it where it's basically a huge muscular version of a road movie, because once they're on the planet, they're constantly moving forward and constantly chasing their goal, which obviously is a driving thing of Mad Max and many other action franchises too.
Yeah.
So obviously Wolf spots some of the women themselves being held captive here in cages and forms a plan to basically get in there. And but unfortunately, Nikki decides to go and check around. As teenagers do, they don't listen. And he says, stay put, go around. But she finds herself stuck in the maze and, of course, finds herself in trouble with all the little gladiators sort of looking things in there, and she is stuck. And, of course, Peter Strauss has to go and rescue her.
Yes, of course.
So what do we think of this last big climactic action scene? They're in the pit there. They've got the fire, the flamethrowers, the big, I suppose they're car rigs, aren't they? These huge things with little slicing knives and swords on the sides and stuff like that. It is epic.
Yeah, it's like I said, this is one of the great visual things about this. Because you see them walking outside too, and they shot on location in Arizona. And then it gets mm-hmm. into this other area too of just really creepy looking stuff. I you know, when I think of a lot of the other films out there, I think of movies like Ice Pirates and Buckaroo Banzai yes. and stuff like that. And I think this film rivals those when it comes to the visuals and the settings that they put these characters in.
That's right. Now, obviously, the film too wraps up quite neatly the fact that obviously everything's rescued, and we start to see the three rescue women get away in time. And then Wolf basically asks Nikki whether she wants to stay with him as a partner on the ship, like she had with Chalmers, and basically do exactly that. Rescue, do what they're doing. Call the answer for heroism.
Yeah. The fight scene at the end too with Michael Ironside was pretty cool. You know, and just the, you know, when Nikki was captured and stuff, but I did like the way that it ended. It leaves you kind of wanting to see more of these two together. Yes. You know, and I know she's young. I don't think there would ever been like a romantic thing between them, but I could definitely see them being kind of like partners.
Oh yeah, definitely. So let's talk about the production itself. One of the first things we're going to talk about is that it was shot in Cane Creek in Bull Canyon, Colorado River. So have you ever been to this sort of area of the US?
I've been to Colorado, but the Colorado River goes through more than just Colorado. It's a long thing, and I think it goes through Arizona, if I remember correctly.
Mm.
This is also filmed in other parts of Arizona as well. It's just beautiful kind of desert locations, but that Colorado River goes for quite a while.
Mm. Obviously in Potash, Lower Schaefer Trail, Potash Settling Ponds, Gray Hills, in US Highway 91 as well, near the Canyonlands Airport. So interesting. So it's they're using a lot of these massive areas where they're a bit more barren, a bit more desert-like, but definitely otherworldly.
Yeah, definitely.
So let's have a look at some of the other things, the actual film itself. So the release itself was advertised as 3D, obviously, pushing that element in the early 80s that was very popular. And Columbia released it on May 20, 1983, as you said before, a week before Return of the Jedi, and grossed over $16.5 million at the box office.
I think that was a good return for that movie at that time, you know? Mm. You know, I'm trying to remember how much the budget of the film. So it was $14 million budget. Opening weekend yep. was a little over $7 million, and then the gross a little over $16 million. I think it did better on video, too. or there was a good amount added to the total because of video.
Yeah, well, the budget of the film was estimated $14.4 million. So they made another, whatever it was, $2 million on top, which is great. Opening weekend, it did $7 million. So it's quite high. I mean, almost more than half.
Yeah, I mean, for that amount of time, sure. People waiting to see Return of the Jedi wanted some science fiction now, and so they went and saw this.
Yeah, you know, you got the average Joe cinema goer, and you know, hey man, you got some sci-fi out there? I want to see that.
Exactly.
Oh, great. the release obviously too had great reception. Variety called it a muddled science fiction tale. And basically saying that the editing prevented audiences from enjoying well action well-shot action scenes. Well,
I don't think I disagree with that.
Same here. I'm going to have to say the same. I think it looked good.
Yeah, me too.
He didn't quite do, like, here's one thing that I liked about the scenes. They pulled the cameras back so you could see what was going on. Yeah. They didn't do that silly Chris Nolan thing where I want to get into the ugly of the fight. Let's go right in.
Yeah.
You can't say that kind of thing.
That kind of herky jerky camera movement, you didn't really get that here. You got a lot of wide shots, which I appreciated.
And then Jeanette Maslin of the New York Times at the time wrote that the film does more with its 3D than its contemporaries had, but it's a bit too crowded and derivative of ideas to be memorable. Mm. Interesting. Well, I think that there is quite a few ideas in there, but to me, I was looking at more modern films of what could be similar, and in fact that they try and do maybe two or three different ideas or different plot ideas in one film. And I go to Riddick, so the third film in the Pitch Black series, if you like. And that film has three different things going on. So it's got a an alien environment and has the monsters as the first half. Then we have bounty hunters, and then we have Riddick himself, all have threats or be threats in a film. And this, I think that's the same. We have the start of the film be kind of like a space film. The second part is an on-land vehicle film. And the third part is a gladiator movie.
Yeah, I would agree. Yeah, that's a good comparison. Yeah.
Definitely. So we had Paul Mavis review the 2017 Blu-ray release for Movies and Drinks. He wrote, with an incident busy script, something is going on all the time. The action is tolerable, low-grade road warrior approximation. The set pieces are reasonably imaginative, and a lot of weirdo stuff is crammed into the fast runtime. I think he's pretty much distilled it down. That's pretty much what it is.
Yeah, but I would put a more of a positive spin on that. It kind of has a negative connotation to it, but he's pretty much right. Because there's a lot of weird stuff in this.
There is. Rotten Tomatoes gave it 18% approval rating. Really?
Yeah, that really surprises me. Yeah.
Mm.
I don't know. I'm not saying necessarily – I mean, to a certain degree – a lot of this stuff kind of holds up in my mind, especially with a lot of, as I've been talking about, a lot of the practical effects. And I just think it's a fun adventure film, you know?
Yep. Doesn't take itself too seriously. And you know, you have characters that are in every space opera in there. You know, you've got your Han Solo, you've got your pirate, can you trust him sort of character. And you've got, the Apprentice, which is Molly Ringwald there, you know? So it's all there. But I think it was quite good. Now the music score, what did we think about that by Elmer Bernstein?
You know, to me, it's not very memorable. It kind of serves it does its job, you know?
Yeah.
So I'm not going to say that's a knock against it. But like the one thing that about the music is the opening theme that you get when the movie starts and it shows the title of the movie and who's in it. It's very Star Warsy, space operatic, you know, or what is it, Flash Gordon-y or Buck Rogers type thing. And it definitely is the right type of music for it. I'm just going to say it doesn't stand out, but it does its job.
Yeah, I think it's not the thing that I take away from the film is not the music, that's for sure. But it fits. It certainly fits it. So, folks, we're going to take a short break. Go and check out this little promo with a guy by the name of Kevin the Reader Reitzel.
Thank you for listening. We hope you're enjoying this podcast. We'd like to recommend these other great podcasts on the Fandom Podcast Network. It starts with our flagship show, Culture Clash, our weekly pop culture podcast with the latest news, reviews, and other fun topics in pop culture. Also, Blood of Kings, a Highlander podcast where we discuss all things Highlander. Couch Potato Theater, our podcast celebrating the cult classic and fan favorite movies we don't get off the couch for. Time Warp, a look back on our classic and nostalgic fandoms that we still celebrate today. The End Zone, our podcast talking about all things current in the NFL and giving our best mediocre fantasy football advice. Good Evening, an Alfred Hitchcock podcast. Discoville, a Star Trek Discovery and the Orville podcast. The Hair Metal podcast, if you're a hard rock music fan, the Hair Metal podcast rediscovers the nostalgia of the 1980s hair metal bands. and Type 40, a Doctor Who podcast, as we discuss all things Doctor Who, past and present. You can find these great shows on the Fandom Podcast Master Feed at fpnet.podbean.com. The Fandom Podcast Network is on iTunes, Stitcher, Podbean, Google Play. On Facebook, you can find us at Fandom Podcast Network. On Instagram, we are at Fandom Podcast Network. And on Twitter, at FanPod Network. You can also email us directly at fandompodcastnetwork@gmail.com. Thank you so much for listening and support the Fandom Podcast Network. And remember, respect others and enjoy your fandom.
You've seen him as the Punisher from Marvel Comics. You've seen him in Universal Soldier alongside Jean-Claude Van Damme playing Sergeant Andrew Scott. And now you can see him in his own kitchen cooking with Dolph. That's right, break bread with Dolph. And also check out how he makes sausage rolls, pastries, and of course cooks Frankfurts. All at home with Dolph. That's right, he must break you. Break you into cooking. That's right, cooking with Dolph. Be sure to check it out right now.
I must break you.
Hi, this is Christoph Waltz. You might know me from such roles as Hans Landa in, of course, Quentin Tarantino's Inglourious Basterds. Well, guess what? I have a new movie. It is called Highlander. I play a guy with a sword. That's right. No one can kill me unless they cut off my head. That's right. Christoph Waltz, MacLeod.
And welcome back, folks. We're here with a little bit of trivia for the one, the only, Space Hunter, Adventures in the Forbidden Zone. And we're going to be looking at just some of the different things that you may not know about this film. Especially out here in Australia, limited release, VHS, went gangbusters, but do we remember it? And have you picked up the Blu-ray?
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up because I can't remember what it was exactly that made me want to go watch it again, but I ended up buying it on Blu-ray. And I'll tell you right now, though, it's light on special features. Let's just put it this way. There is none.
But interactive menus?
But yeah, interactive menus. There you go. But it's the transfer in Blu-ray is still really good. But I got to give a shout out to my friend Scott out of Charlotte, North Carolina. He and I have done a lot of gaming in the past. He's a good guy. And when I made a post about this on Facebook about a year or so ago, I said, you got to check out this film. And he's like, oh, no way. And he still has an old video store that rents videos, not just DVDs, but also VHS. And he went there, and I've been to this place before. It's phenomenal. And he actually picked up the VHS copy of Space Hunter and watched it because of the recommendation that I did.
Oh, wow. Scott, you are a legend.
He is. Bloody legend, I give him full props for doing that, and that is awesome.
Five stars for you, mate. Tell you, unbelievable.
Scott Bowman, great job, man.
All right, let's dig into this trivia. The first one, did you know the writers were actually from Marvel Comics?
Yeah, I thought this was pretty cool. Get a kind of interesting taste on this, and it really doesn't surprise me after you watch this. Because a lot of these characters are comic book characters coming to life.
Oh, they really were. Now, you've already touched on the R2-D2 sound, but so the science fiction was first released stateside on 20th of May, 1983. Obviously, one of the great things about it tying in a week before Return of the Jedi is also their little nod to it with that R2-D2 noise, I think. You know, yeah, it's a little bit of a hint, yeah, that, you know, hey, mate, we're taking that out of it.
My parents were famous for not wanting to go to the movies on opening weekend because of the crowds. I think Star Wars might have been an exception, but they would usually wait a little while to see films, and they loved going to drive-ins. And I swear we probably saw this movie at a drive-in, not on opening weekend, after Return of the Jedi. Probably saw Return of the Jedi first, saw it a few times, and then we went and saw this, I think.
Yeah, what's interesting is when we saw it, we had a double feature that was on the VHS night that night. We had that and a movie you may have heard of called Greystoke,
The Legend. Oh, yes. Christopher Lambert.
Christophe Lambert. Now, one of the interesting things about that is we also missed that same feature at the Beenleigh Drive-In Theatre where they had it playing along with, I think it was Supergirl.
What was playing with Supergirl?
Was this film.
Oh, Star Hunter, yeah.
Yeah, which was interesting to have those two because they used to play, they'd play something even that might be 1986, 1987, but what they would do is then have the older Prince play after.
You know what? If this film were to go back on the big screen in a limited release, I would see it right away because this is the type of movie you do see on the big screen. And imagine seeing it in 3D too. I would love to see an updated 3D print with your 3D glasses. That would be fantastic.
And the fact that it's real effects in front of you, not this CGI. CGI sharks, you got it. CGI.
Yeah.
Coming at you. So it was common for 3D movies to come out released simultaneously, but to have flat versions, two versions of this movie was shown at different ratios as well. So you got the 2:35:1 and the 1:85:1.
Interesting. Yeah, definitely. What I thought was cool too, and I kind of alluded to it, was that this was part of an early 1980s cycle of 3D movies that also included Star Chaser, The Legend of Orin in 85, Maelstrom, The Destruction of Jared Sin in 83, Jaws 3D in 83, Parasite in 82, Amityville 3D in 83, coming at you at 81, Friday the 13th Part 3 in 82, and of course Space Hunter in 83, and Treasure of the Four Crowns. In 83. There's some of these I'd never heard of, but Amityville I did, Jaws I did, Friday the 13th, but this Metal Storm, The Destruction of Jared Sin, I got to look at that. That sounds cool.
Yeah. I've seen a little bit of that on YouTube. It actually looks pretty good. So obviously, going to have to do Arnold on this one. Here we go. Executive producer Ivan Reitman labeled this Morpheus a space adventure with a sense of humor.
Oh, that's awesome. By the way, the Maelstrom, The Destruction of Jared Sin, stars Trancers star Tim Thomerson.
Yes. Yes, and also, of course, star of Uncommon Valor.
Yes. Ooh, Kelly Preston is in it. And who else is in it? Richard Mall is also in it. Okay, I gotta see this movie.
You got to check it out. Some of the movie posters for the film featured a long preamble. It says, Wolf and Nikki, he's an interstellar adventurer. She's a young rebel. Together, they set out on a mission to rescue three stranded women from a planet no one has warned them about because no one has ever returned.
Yeah, that was like on the whole poster at the top. there was two main posters. One kind of had a picture of a ship. Mm-hmm. And then there was one that showed like the cast in front of it. I like the one in the cast. I thought that one looked better.
Yeah, it looked a bit better. Between the production, the name of the villain, it changed from King Creep to Overdog.
I think Overdog is better.
Oh, yeah. So it was decided to shoot the picture in 3D during the interval in production between the firing of director Jean Lafleur and Lamont Johnson. Interesting.
Hmm.
Crazy, isn't it? So Ivan Reitman is said to have formed his view to shoot in 3D within one day. So Reitman felt the further cost would enhance the picture. Mm.
Yeah, that was a decision that was made kind of at the last minute to do the 3D thing of it. And that's why I wish they would kind of release this on an anniversary or something. And let's see this on the big screen again, because that would be fun.
Yeah. So estimated $2 million extras were spent on the film's budget by the Columbia Pictures Studio and acquisition of specialty lenses for the theaters.
Mm. Yeah.
It's interesting, isn't it? So the Rodox vehicle was a converted Canadian snowcat and snowmobile.
That thing is so cool looking. Yeah.
That's right. The Ramrod and Scrambler vehicles were both built on Dodge make and model pickup truck chassis.
The detail and you can't recognize that because of how much cool stuff they did to those to make them look as cool as they did.
That's right. So Michael Onside uses the same gesture that Kenneth Hickey used in the 1952 Summer Olympics held in Helsinki. Let the games begin. we also, so lots of 3D information here. Because of the 3D format, taglines have changed. The first movie that puts you in outer space.
Here's something I thought was kind of interesting, and I'd never seen this. The April 5th, 1983 edition of the show business trade paper, The Hollywood Reporter, announced the making of Space Hunter 93. Mm-hmm. A made-for-television behind-the-scenes documentary which publicized the movie was in post-production. I said, that's what I wish they would have put on the DVD. That would have been great. Oh, yeah. I would have loved to have seen the behind-the-scenes of this because, you know, talking to people about making the sets and the costumes would have been fantastic.
That's right. So some of this stuff we've already covered, but we've got things like here, the name of the planet Terra 11, nicknamed for the planet's forbidden zone or the zone. The planet's marauders were called zoners. Well, the band of numbers were called the scabs, which we kind of already know, I suppose. Harold Ramis is an uncredited as the executive producer, is the voice of an intercom in this.
Oh, he snuck in there.
He certainly did. And it's when Wolf makes Chalmers. She has been reading a copy of the R.U.R. in bed. This is the famous 1920 science fiction play, which first introduced the word robot. Interesting, isn't it?
Yeah, very, very cool. Very nice.
So as we wrap up, what are your final thoughts on this film? Should there be a reboot? Should we see a sequel? Or should people just get the Blu-ray and enjoy it at their home cinema?
You know, this is one of those films I don't, it falls under a cult classic right now. And
yep.
I mean, I could see someone doing a reboot of this, but the title, Space Hunter Adventures in the Forbidden Zone, I don't think is going to fly with audiences nowadays. This is something that goes back to the old serialized movies and TV series that you don't really see this type of title anymore. It has to be something that is smaller, precise. You know, I just say enjoy the original on your Blu-ray. Enjoy it for what it is. I think it's fine as a one shot. It's not Buckaroo Banzai. I would have loved to have seen a sequel to that or Big Trouble in Little China, stuff like that, which apparently we will be for that movie. But this is just one of those one shot movies you just enjoy for what it is. You know, leave it alone.
I agree. Go and check it out, folks, and check out the Blu-ray without a doubt. And I want to thank Kevin for joining us here as guest co-host tonight on this here podcast. You can check, obviously, out his shows on the FanPod Network. And, of course, I want to thank you, the listeners, for joining us here for another episode of Lethal Mullet Podcast on Fandom Podcast Network. We'll catch you next time. Thanks for joining us. Bye for now.